Behind every mission, there's a plan. Behind every plan, there's a soldier, training, leading, and getting the job done. This is the Kentucky National Guard's G3 podcast, where we share the stories, lessons, and leadership that keep our guard always ready, always there.
Welcome, hello to the G3 podcast, Fixed Bayonets. I am your favorite podcast platoon sergeant, Sergeant B. We have another good episode here in Frankfort, Kentucky. And we are going to talk about some training events, some life-saving events, and things that have been going on in the aviation. And we're going to talk about maybe a recent MOB that happened with the training events. We're going to talk about operational stuff. And for the first time, we have a female soldier on the podcast. So never more, we have Staff Sergeant Ashley Renee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. First female, so don't screw this up. <I'm a guest. laughs> No, so we have a lot to talk about, actually. With you, let's go a little bit into your history first. Let's just do this. So your military background, you were split up, right?
Correct.
Joined at 17. So yep. People don't know that. 17.
Day after my 17th birthday.
Okay. Had to get that permission slip signed?
I did. Yeah. The recruiter showed up to my house.
Yeah.
Sat down at the kitchen table.
What started that though? What did you talk to a recruiter already? What brought it up?
My dad was a Marine.
Okay.
I come from a military family background already.
Mm-hmm.
Very humble beginnings.
Right.
And my dad sat me down and said, like, you know, you haven't really made the best grades to pay for your own college. I don't have money for college, so if you want to get out of this town, you should probably join the military. And so that's what I did.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just made a career out of it.
Okay. So at 17, split op. For people who don't know, that's you go to boot camp first.
Yes, correct.
And then you complete your boot camp, you come back, finish school.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been your junior or senior summer, right?
That works? My junior summer
okay.
going into my senior year.
Okay. And then you come back, finish your senior year, then you go back to AIT, right? There's
correct.
No – okay. Mm-hmm. So you're split op, 17 years old, you join the military.
Yes.
All right, so you joined the Kentucky Army National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
What instead of going active and stuff like that, what made you do the Guard? Is it just because of you could join at 17 to the split up?
Yeah, I've always kind of wanted to do something in the medical field.
Okay.
And I had plans for college at the time, so I wanted something that I could do part-time, something
Makes
that
sense.
I could
yep.
pay for school, and then I can also work on the civilian side, and the Guard gave me those benefits to do that.
Okay. Yeah, it works out, don't it?
Yeah.
That's cool. So you do the split op. What is your MOS?
I enlisted initially as a 6'8 whiskey healthcare specialist, also known as a ground medic.
Yeah, God bless you. I can't do it. I'm not a medical person. I had Sergeant First Class Low, which you probably know.
Yes.
Oh, God bless y'all for doing that. But that's what you wanted to do. You wanted to go into the nursing type field. So,
mm-hmm.
okay. So enlisted in it, go to boot camp, go back to school, come back to AIT. Where was it at?
It was at Fort Sam in San Antonio, Texas.
Okay. Tough? Was it tough?
As a 18-year-old girl, it was tough.
Yeah.
You know, going into the military lifestyle after essentially just being a kid mm-hmm. in high school, it's a completely different world out there. So adjusting from high school life
right.
to such a structured mm-hmm. Facility, you know, there was some adapting
yeah.
that
right.
had to occur. But after I got the hang of things, you know, the schooling was easy. You know, I
yeah.
just graduated high school. School's easy. I can look at a book and remember
sense.
Things.
Yeah.
So AIT itself was pretty simple for me, but just adjusting to the real adult world as a 18-year-old fresh out of high school was
right.
was challenging.
Yeah. So you come back from AIT, and so you're in the Guard. Did you go right into college from there?
So I never actually used my college benefits.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
I just let the Army kind of take me
okay.
wherever I wanted.
Yeah.
Although with my AIT stuff, I did get my EMT license,
mm-hmm.
Which is a national certification.
Right. Okay.
You can take that back home, get a Kentucky state license, and work as an EMT anywhere in the state of Kentucky.
Very
so,
cool.
It did
That's
open
cool.
up some windows for me, and
yeah.
I started my career in emergency medicine as an emergency room technician.
Okay.
So,
so it's kind of a dual thing for you, though, the AIT for the military / civilian life. I didn't know that part of it, that you got certified as an EMT
yeah.
for the state of Kentucky.
Yeah. That was another reason why I wanted to do the medical field, because I knew I would get some sort of civilian licensure
yeah.
that I could use and actually kind
right.
of sustain a lifestyle as a young adult.
Okay.
So that's what I did. I took my license back home, and I immediately got a job as an emergency room tech at the local ER in the town that I was living in.
Okay. That's very cool. And I like to bring stuff like that up for our listeners and stuff, or people that's thinking about joining that's listening. Or, you know, that's, that might be an option, especially if that's a field they're interested in. God knows I'm not. I wouldn't make it through it. But, I mean, that's very cool, though. So cool. On here, as a note, I see, though, you became a flight paramedic as well, though.
Yes.
So is that something you did in the military and on the civilian side both, or is that just a military thing?
That was just a military thing.
Okay.
So going back to the military civilian life, the flight paramedic program is a great opportunity for young medics seeking to go beyond the ground medic position. There's nothing wrong with being a ground medic, but if you want to expand your knowledge, get into that critical care world, flight paramedic is such a good route to go. And speaking about Jeremy Lowe, he's the one who got me started. You know, I started harassing him and being like, I want to do this. Yeah. I want to do this. It is a well sought after position. And, you know, you have to board, you have to do resumes, you have to do in-person interviews. The process to become a flight paramedic is no small feat.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Lowe, he took a giant leap of faith on me, and he was like, you know what, I'm going to give you a chance. Here in the next 2 months, there's a flight paramedic seat open. It's a year-long school, but it's yours if you want it. And so I said, yeah, heck yeah, absolutely, let's do it.
That's awesome. God bless Jeremy Lowe. I've known him over the last several months, so yes, that's great. That's so cool. And then, okay, so for units, what units have you been in since you've been in?
So directly after AIT, I was in the 1204th Aviation Support Battalion,
okay.
Which is kind of showing my age a little bit, because that's been disbanded for a long time. It's always been connected to 63rd TAB, though. So that unit was a support battalion of the 63rd TAB.
Okay.
It was disbanded, so I didn't have a home for a little bit.
Right.
They sent me to HHC in the 63rd TAB,
okay.
where I was a ground medic, and I did flight physicals for our aviators. Mm-hmm. And that was our main focus. We'd sometimes do like range support and stuff, but that's kind of what started my love for aviation and my want to be a flight paramedic.
Cool. Yeah. And then you went from 63rd TAB to where you're at now?
Is that where I went to 63rd TAB to the medevac. I did flight paramedic school, and I was in the medevac as an M-Day soldier for a while.
Okay.
A couple years. And then I got an opportunity for an AGR position as the Brigade Medical Readiness NCO. So I went from the medevac back to HHC in the 63rd TAB for the progression of my AGR career.
Was you, and it's a conversation we had previous podcast, did you do a lot of orders as well besides just the schools? Would you, do you ever do ADOS or something like that?
Anytime there was ADOS,
you jumped
I'm
on
like,
it?
Sign me up, ADOS. Yeah, calling people up if there's ADOS orders. That's the best way. If you are interested in an AGR job, you just got to get your name out there.
Right.
Show people your work ethic. Make people want to invest in you. That's the way to
do it. That's awesome. I mean, that's literally what we've been talking about in these previous ones. I like to put that out there for those soldiers that are, that want to make a kind of a career or how I get started. And a big thing is those ADOS holders when they put them out there. Because I've seen so many times, even for me at the unit level, being a readiness NCO or whatever, you push some info out and you're like, hey, I know some of you don't have a lot going on right now. And you love this stuff. Like, here's an opportunity to go do this, that. You might have to travel here, but get your foot in the door, you know, and do these orders. It's, you know, good money, whatever. But this could start the career, and you never know where you end up. That's the craziest thing about it.
Yes.
So it's just like overall consensus. I like to ask at this point, hey, have you done ADOS or have you jumped on orders? Because usually it leads into an AGR career or something like that. And it's the best thing ever happened to you. You know?
Yes, it really is.
That's awesome. So, okay, so aviation, you started AGR. That was in 2022, right?
Yes.
Okay, and you're a readiness NCO for it?
I'm readiness NCO for the medevac now. So I am out of HAT and back into 2nd of 238th.
That's what I've noticed with aviation. So I do the net fieldings here in Frankfurt for the new equipment, and that was one thing I didn't really know a lot about. My wife, she's an M-Day soldier, and she started out in the 63rd TAB, but I went over there and I'm like, hey, where's 376, where's 63rd TAB, where's, you know, I don't, it's like they're all in the same building. It's a beast, it's a beast. And it's like medevacs over here and
lots of line units within one giant organization.
But great people. I mean, every time I go over there, very welcoming. I've done some fieldings, other armories and stuff like that. So all right, well, Sergeant Renee, before we start jumping into the training portion, let's since we kind of know who you are, let's take a little quick break. And when we come back, we'll kind of jump into the different training events that you have done over, even as an M-Day, some of the, especially that medical field and stuff that you had learned over the years that's kind of progressed your experience to to lead up to some of these life-saving events or state of emergencies that we've had that it's really come into play and it's made you successful. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right, we'll be back. Welcome back to the G3P. I'm Sergeant B. I'm sitting here talking with Sergeant Renee from the Medevac, and we've been covering kind of her background history in the military and what she has done to progress in her career and for the upcoming training events that's going to she's going to endure over the years. But before, let's give a shout out to our sponsors. So I know we get stressed sometimes and we want to take care of ourselves mentally and we want to be healthy. So I want to give a shout out to the stress ball, the simple stress ball right here. Look, this is how easy. I know it annoys somebody else, but it'll make you feel good. Good Lord. Any kind, I know people can call this a racket ball, but this is mine. I like to balance it. So when you're stressed, you just needed some relief, get a stress ball. Don't be punching stuff. Don't be kicking things over, yelling. I mean, you can take this thing anywhere. You can bounce it off the commander's office just like that. I mean, you can do whatever you want to do. So shout out to the stress ball. Let's all be a little bit calmer when we're working with each other. And you can get these anywhere. I don't even know where I got this from. I took it from somebody. There you go, Crane. Thank you. We're back. Sergeant Renee, welcome. You're not stressed, right? We're having a good time. No. Got a good plant. Spring has sprung. I want to dive back into that, the flight paramedic, because it is interesting to me on the medical side of the field and people that are listening that we have a ground medic. Hold on. What's a 68 whiskey actually called? I always just said medic. You called it?
Healthcare specialist.
Yeah, see, I don't even know that. And I've been in, 16 years. So, medic, you know what I mean? So, 68 whiskey. Ground medic is when you're first kind of in. That's mm-hmm. working with, I'm assuming, just any kind of unit. They attach you out because yes. we always had medics with us. But yes. Loved my medics. I mean, there's one person you want on your good side, what I always said. But mm-hmm. great. I mean, just it's a daunting task to be a medic. I mean, you're caring for the welfare of everybody. So, but the flight paramedic, I've heard, Sergeant Lowe talk about it as well. What is the big difference? Like, what happens once you become that flight paramedic? What was the training that you had to do to become one?
So the biggest difference is the acuity of patients that you are capable to take care of.
Okay.
It's also the equipment that we carry. And then you're also doing it in a loud, vibrating machine that's floating in the air.
Yeah.
So you're now off the ground, mm-hmm. in the air, in an environment that's sometimes and often dark. It's loud. You can't speak to your patients. So the acuity of patients that you're taking care of is typically higher because your certification is higher. So you've gone from EMT to paramedic to critical care paramedic,
okay.
which is like three separate levels
okay.
that you're going up. So in the back of our helicopters, we have everything that you'll find in an ER and an ICU.
That's crazy.
And we manage populations from neonates, babies, pediatrics, regular soldiers.
What was neonates?
Babies.
Okay.
Babies.
I've dropped this
tiny,
line before.
Brand new babies.
Yeah, all right.
Brand okay. new babies.
All right.
we can take care of OBGYN emergencies. We can deliver babies, geriatric
insane.
Patients,
yeah.
Anybody we are capable to take okay. care of in the back of that aircraft.
Gotcha. That is wild. And you said it's a year long to do that? To kind of get that certification again?
Yes. So all in all, the training is over a year long if you lay everything out on the table. So in order to even go to flight paramedic school, you have to have that ground medic certification. So you have to have the basic AIT of a healthcare specialist. That is your fundamental ground point you have to start at.
Yeah.
After that, if you do what's called the pipeline, there are several different ways you can go into flight paramedicine. But the Army pipeline is the way that I did it. So I didn't have any sort of paramedic certification.
Mm-hmm.
So I went as an EMT. And at the time that I went, the Army had a partnership with UTESCA, which is the University of San Antonio. And I went to the Health and Science Center. So they sent me to college and paid me full time
yeah.
to do nothing but go to school.
That's awesome.
For 10 months. And the first 6 months of that school was in San Antonio. I lived TDY, live off post in a little apartment. I had my daughter with me at the time. She was about 6 months old. Went to school for about 6 months to get my paramedic license. Super challenging with a six-month-old child.
God, that is crazy.
It's nothing but studying, and a standard paramedic course is about a year or two long. So you think it's such a condensed, fast version that
yeah.
you're just cramming information, and it's stressful because if you fail a test, or I think the max you could fail at was two tests, and you're booted from the program. So. Mm-hmm. They don't take these courses lightly.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to be there, you really have to work hard and you really have to study. So that first portion of the flight paramedic course was that paramedic portion. Got certified. After that, I rolled directly into the critical care portion, which is about a two-month course. Same facility in San Antonio through the same college, which they don't do any longer. It's completely led by Army instructors now. So okay. They have done away with the University of San Antonio.
Okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And they are teaching it completely on their own. But my experience was with the college.
Right.
So got my FPC, which is Flight Paramedic Certification. And that is a crucial part that you need to be a flight paramedic, obviously. And it's just a national certification stating that you can complete air medical medicine on patients anywhere in the U.S. So I got my license for that. And then after about 9 months in San Antonio, I got to go home for a few days. And then I had to go directly back in about 4 days to Fort Rucker, Alabama for a 28-day course, which entailed lots of hot days and flight simulators. Mm-hmm. And you're just doing nothing but taking care of simulated patients with state-of-the-art mannequins. I mean, these mannequins will blink at you. They'll speak to you. The pupils will dilate. They'll have tension pneumothoraxes, so they'll have unequal rise and fall of the chest. They'll bruise. Their abdomens will distend. So you're spending all day with these mannequins, yeah. And it's just like treating a real person.
Yeah.
The vital signs monitors that they give you directly correlate to the disease patterns that they have, whether it be metabolic or trauma. So for 28 days, you're learning air medical medicine, which is different than ground medicine because you have different gas laws.
Yeah.
Gas exchange is different up in the air at different altitudes.
Yeah.
You're learning flight physiology. You're working with pilots. You're working with crew chiefs. It's a completely different environment. So within those 28 days, you're learning so much about air medical medicine versus just plain ground paramedicine.
That is crazy. Mm-hmm. Those mannequin things, I've seen the videos, I've heard Jeremy talk about it and what they can do. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Did you start talking to mannequins when you got back?
What is it?
You was around the mannequins for so long. Did you talk to mannequins when you came back?
Oh, yeah. I'm just so used to treating mannequins that treating real patients was, what do I even do with this thing? Crazy. Like, you actually breathe.
Yeah. So intensive training, obviously, mm-hmm. We know why, we're saving lives. And so we get back, we're a flight paramedic now. What's some training aspects that y'all do in aviation? Like, what could y'all do on drill? Is there anything that's y'all are standardly doing? It's something that you always done, or is y'all always training like with hoists? I don't
yes.
know. Educate me.
So though it is rare, a hoist mission is something that we try to always be prepared for. Because it's the most inherently dangerous thing that we do, because it's you on the ground making decisions solely as a medic, mm-hmm. and your patient. You kind of don't know what you're getting into whenever you are called to a scene. You got to figure it out when you get to the ground, so you can't really plan ahead because you have multiple different extraction devices. So everything is kind of done by the seat of your pants, and you really just have to trust your instincts and your training to make the right decision for your patient, because there is no right or wrong. It's life or death whenever it comes to a hoist patient. One slip of a rig and your patient, it could end badly.
Right.
So that's something that we train almost every month if we can.
Well, because I think it's wise. I mean, as a patient, we always hear you're trying to stabilize, take mm-hmm. care, do all the right movements. But not only are you trying to stabilize somebody to maybe hoist them up to put them in, an ambulance or something like that, but mm-hmm. you're literally hoisting them up. So even just the strapping down is a big deal here, keeping them stable and stuff. So those practices, to me, seems mm-hmm. like y'all would constantly be practicing that.
Yeah, and we reach out to our civilian counterparts, so local EMSs and local search and rescues. We do lots of partnership trainings with them because those are the people we're doing our patient handoffs with.
Yeah.
It's not only just paramedicine. We're also doing search and rescue.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody falls down at the gorge or off a cliff and, if they can't be walked out or they can't walk themselves out, they're calling us in for a hoist mission.
Yeah.
We have 300 feet of usable cable, which is a very high hoist. But some of the trees and the canyons out there are very deep. So we're constantly trying to reach out to our civilian counterparts and just have the smoothest transition whenever it comes to these sick patients.
And that's a great point, as we always talk about with a guard in the community. You know, and for you guys, it's really huge. You know, we have to work that way. So, yeah, I think that's a good question that we talked to some other units with, you know, whatever they're doing, whether it be the MPs or the joint kind of training they do. And a lot of times, you know, it's like we talk about working with the civilian side. And, you know, that's the cool thing about the guard sometimes is, you know, we can do the operational national level, we'll, you know, go overseas or whatever, but we also get called by our state because that's who we're owned with. And we make those decisions as well when those state of emergencies arises. So is that something that, with that, learning that, do y'all go out for drills and take, like, the M-Day soldiers, do they go out and actually do some of this stuff too as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If we do something as a unit training event, it takes everybody.
Yeah.
Because we have fuelers, we have mechanics. Aircraft love to break.
Right.
It's not just about flying and doing, you know, supporting the paramedics in the back.
Right.
That is the mission, but it takes everybody to make the mission possible. You have to have somebody to fuel the aircraft, to set up a hot FARP. You know, you can't just pull an aircraft up to a gas station. Like, there has to be a setting. You have to find a field. You got to park a Hemet out there, you know. Like, it takes a lot of planning, and it's all hands on deck, the entire unit.
Yeah, and you're making great points, because we had talked earlier in a podcast about the infantry, and the infantry starting to make, hey, if we go out training, everybody's training. And it ain't just the 11 Bravos, right? It's your admin support, probably the medics that are with them. We were talking about the maintenance people. They all kind of train together. So it's the same situation that you don't really think about. I always, and I'm bad about it too, I'm thinking everybody's flight paramedics, right? Everybody in this unit. And then you're like, no, we got to have these people, this, because everything has to run. So just knowing that, everybody knowing their job. So that team cohesion is a big deal for sure.
And every single part, like, I'll say, I do think that the paramedics get a lot of the praise whenever we go on these missions. But without our fuelers, without our mechanics, without the crew chiefs operating the hoist, without our comms people, our papas, you know, if we can't talk to each other in the air, we're essentially useless.
Yeah.
So it's all just a huge moving part.
Yeah. So before, and which I know we'll get into a little bit later, we're going to talk about Kosovo, the deployment y'all just came off of. Was there anything for kind of that ramp up that y'all, did y'all change anything out, or did stuff start picking up, the training, or was there anything, I guess for some people, like when we, you know, we go to a, you know, the pre-MOB, we go to a lot of other training lanes as well, but was y'all doing stuff throughout the year to start checking the block or making sure, hey, we're all on the same page? Did y'all do anything like that before y'all moved out to Kosovo?
Yes. So not only were there specific training requirements that the medics had to do specifically, us as a unit, we tried to do a huge just hoist training event out of the gorge. And it took a lot of preparation.
Right.
It took months of preparation and getting OKs and getting things signed off. We had to get land agreements from the gorge themselves to let us hoist and train. So we went out there for about a week. And we did nothing but set up patient scenarios. And we do multiple types of hoisting. So we do what's called static, which the aircraft is stationary in the air. You just cable down, cable up. And then we do what's called dynamic hoisting, which the aircraft is moving and paramedic and patient are moving up and down on the cable while the aircraft is moving. So for a week long, we did nothing but
So the whole training. I like you talking about that setup too. You had to recon this whole bad boy. I mean, that sounds huge. Because a lot of people we talk about with the units is, hey, you can utilize other places, but the land agreement. Now, you hear that a lot, too. Make sure you get the right paperwork done and getting it signed off and talking to the right people. So you're already kind of networking. Who'd y'all network with for the gorge? Was it something with the Fish and Wildlife or the Park Rangers?
Okay. Yeah, Park Rangers, Fish and Wildlife. And then it wasn't just the medevac out there. We had Wolf County Search and Rescue, we had Red Star EMS, we had Jessamine County coming out, who we do our swift water rescue with. We had brought all these people to the facility and did a mass hoist training event, so they knew exactly how to rig our hoist, and if they had to hop on, they could safely put themselves on and ride the hoist and get off the hoist whenever that time came. They would ride tandem with us. It was a huge event.
That's amazing. And that's something you always remember as well. But your soldiers and stuff, once again, I mean, that training, very beneficial.
Yes.
Makes you very efficient, not just the Guard, but I mean, even on that civilian side, because like you said, y'all been out there before to do those missions, mm-hmm. and you depend on those other entities to perform as well. I mean, yes. You're all got to be a team. So when did that take place? Was that right before the MOB? Was that something y'all did before the MOB?
It was April of 24.
Okay.
So in the summertime, it's the best time to do it.
Yeah.
We were pretty busy with MOB due outs and trainings
right.
leading up to that. But that was probably our biggest training event that we did.
Pretty successful. Did you learn a lot? Was there things that you, like, did you take away things that was like, hey, this may not have worked this way. Maybe we should have done it this way.
Yeah, I think there was lots of learning points. The aircraft broke a bunch of times.
Right.
Hoist cable broke a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Medics ended up having to hoist off of a, or having to rappel off of a rock because our hoist cable broke. So because of that training, we were able to order self-rescue rope rescue kits.
Mm-hmm.
So in case we ever find ourselves in a situation where we're stuck on top of a cliff, we can safely rappel ourselves down.
Yeah. So was you the AGR then?
Yes.
So what was you doing? That's why I like to talk about this whole thing here. So you're running into some issues,
mm-hmm.
and you did the land agreements to get land to train on. Here I am. I'm hitting the new equipment. Look at me. But like you said, you had to order some stuff. Mm-hmm. So you had to figure out how to go order that and who to get that signed off on, right?
Yes.
So you were learning a lot right before you're getting ready to deploy anyways, mm-hmm. to do all this. Okay. So you got to learn to rappel. Keep going.
So we have a really great medic section.
Yeah.
And everybody brings their own piece to the table. We have two that are really big into search and rescue and rope rescue.
Okay.
And we have one who's, what's the ram's head? Mountain Warfare? Yeah, Mountain Warfare. So having those people on the team really helped me
that
out.
Knowledge. Yeah.
Yes. And so getting the equipment was something that I never really, this was my first time as a readiness NCO, especially
right.
going out the door for a MOB.
Yeah.
So getting this new equipment, I learned all about ONS statements and putting in those requests. Mm-hmm. And you say, I need this. This is why. And the state says, all right.
Yeah.
You're going on MOB for sure.
Right.
And so we were able to get a bunch of stuff.
Big, yeah. That networking and learning mm-hmm. the people, too, though, that can bless off on this or help you. Because I was kind of the same boat as you. I was a training CO, transitioned to the readiness, and then we were deploying out. And mm-hmm. I was kind of like you. I was getting stuff in or getting – I was just asking questions. And the big thing about the Guard, though, that I do love is I would just call people. You know, I was just calling.
Yeah.
Hey, this might not be your lane, but it might be. I'm going to ask you this question. And 90% of the time, they're like – not me, but I'll show you where to go, that type thing. And you're trying to get all that stuff approved. So I know the stressors of that, but it's amazing being trying to be successful, though, before you go out the door. Because, I mean, like I said, it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yes.
That's crazy. What other things did y'all do throughout the year? Did y'all do anything else that was besides that? What was some of the other things you were kind of knocking? Is there something you expect of the soldiers when they first show up that they already know what they're going to do this drill or whatever?
I think the soldiers are – we are very I'm going to say we're an advanced unit, and people just, they know what to do whenever
right.
they show up.
Yeah.
We push out a training schedule.
Yeah.
Here's the ins and outs of what we're going to do, and everyone just shows up and kind of starts working.
And they know what to do.
Yes.
And those NCOs will take off with the training and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it.
I think that's what makes our unit so successful is because you have that type of operational level. People just know their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
People know each other. They know how each other's going to work. This is your job. This is my job. And everybody just does the work that needs to be done.
And that's amazing.
Yes.
That's that same sheet of music. And mm-hmm. and being that is a, with the stressors of what y'all do, that is the better part of it, though, is those happening. Because, you know, you have the units where you got a lot of soldiers with different MOSs and got different roles and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And you're trying to make sure everybody's engaged and make sure who's trained up on what. And you're checking medical readiness. You're checking, you know, height, weight, IWQ, all that stuff. And it's like you're always – but, like, when you get those good NCOs that come in there and they can lay on the training for you. You're like, hey, here's the game plan. Go execute, right? And they just pick up and go. It makes life so much easier.
It really does.
But when you see them perform, too, as well, it really – to me, it motivates me seeing when soldiers take the reins and go – and they enjoy what they're doing. They're determined and seeing that. So
yeah, a good example. Leading up to the MOB, you know, we knew from the get go to get ready for the MOB. We knew that we were going to be flying single medic.
Okay.
And with a critical care patient, you have two hands.
Okay.
And it's just you in the back.
Yeah.
And those two hands get occupied very, very quickly, and it can be overwhelming and stressful. So our crew chiefs.
Did you typically train with two medics, though? What's the typical?
If you
have a teammate rider, yes. I'm assuming.
We like to ride dual medic if we can. Okay. Absolutely. So stateside.
So knowing you're going over there, you're going single.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. All right. So we were used to doing dual medic, and it's nice to have someone to just bounce ideas off of. You know, you have a critical patient, you're like, what do you think about this medication? What do you think about this vital sign? Are we trending? Are we going the right direction? And just having somebody to bounce those ideas off.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like a sense of relief. Like you know you're doing the right thing,
yeah.
But it's like I know we're on the same page.
Feel, for me, any kind of scenario like that where I have a backup, you feel a little more confident.
Yes.
I ain't gonna fail.
Yeah.
I'll wing it this way or whatever, and mm-hmm. I'll go this way. You feel more confident because you've got that person to fall back on.
Yes.
And now you don't.
Yeah, so we're single medic, so we're like, you know what? Our crew chiefs are super motivated. They're always trying to help us in the back. So we train them up on all of our vital signs machines, and like, this is how you hook them up for a cardiac patient. This is how you put. Yeah. This is how you take a blood pressure, if you want to do SpO2 monitoring. So, anytime that we had a patient, our crew chiefs, we didn't have to touch the vital signs monitor. Our crew chiefs immediately started hooking the patients up, recording vital signs. They'd set timers. They'd record vitals every 5 minutes. If we needed something, they would usually go ahead and have an IV start. An IV start kit in their hand saying, here you go. They take our needles, put them in Sharps containers. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Just having that level of motivation and people just wanting to do the job, it's a love of the mission, and it showed throughout the MOB.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
So let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to kind of jump into those scenarios we all got yourselves into over in Kosovo and the things mm-hmm. that you... Real quick, let's talk about what's on this table, just real quick. What the hell is this thing?
So those are cardiac defibrillation paddles.
All right.
Now, I've been in emergency medicine for over...
They're 50... not real right now?
No. It's safe to go.
Okay. All right.
So those will hook up to a defibrillator machine.
Okay.
You have to charge it, set your energy, which is in joules, and then you place it on the chest.
There you go.
Yeah, and then you can shock somebody's heart.
Shock the hell out of them.
Yeah, whatever they need.
I feel like there's some power in these things.
Oh, there is. It's like getting kicked in the chest with a horse, you know? but I've been in emergency medicine for 10 years, and I've never used these. So these are cool.
The old school
these sets. Are nostalgic. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All
yeah, right. These are way cooler than what we use now.
Well, cool. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back and let's get into some of those the mission, the Kosovo mission. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right, we'll get you back here. Welcome back to the G3P, Sergeant B. We're here with Sergeant Renee from the Medevac. We've been talking about the training that she has been doing over the years, from ground medic to a flight paramedic, and what she has been doing over at the Medevac with her soldiers and their train up for basically Kosovo, which they just got back from here recently. And before we jump into that, let's talk about the pre-MOB process, because we all kind of have to go through that. Where did y'all do your pre-MOB at?
So we were at Fort Hood in Texas.
Okay, good and hot, huh?
The hottest week of the year.
Really?
Yes.
Nice. That's how it works in the Army,
every
huh?
time.
So how long were y'all down there for?
We were down there for about 28 days.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual exercise itself, the big meat and potatoes event, was about a week long.
Okay. With that, so I've already heard something, it came up, right? Mm-hmm. An actual emergency. Something that was kind of a practice to real life.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. So that specific training day was, it's about 108 degrees outside. Very hot, direct sunlight, no clouds, no shade. That day was our MASCAL training day, mm-hmm. and we were just getting nine lines after nine lines after nine lines.
Right.
And everybody was just hot and exhausted. So we kind of expected some heat casualties.
Yeah.
So we went ahead and pre-prepped our aircraft with ice sheets and coolers in case we were to encounter an actual heat casualty. But we kind of tucked it away in the corner. So I get a mission. I'm the medic on this call, and I go out. I respond to a MASCAL event, and so I'm working the scene whenever I get there. I'm packaging up my patients. I'm coordinating movements, and then one of the instructors who's evaluating me comes up to me, and he says, I need you to stop what you're doing. Somebody is having a heat stroke over here. And so I dropped what I was doing. Yes.
Yeah.
And the OIC of the training came to me and he said, I'm sorry to ask this of you, but can you take this patient to the hospital?
Oh, shit.
Okay. And I said, yeah, of course I can.
Yeah.
I have everything I need. So I get on my radio. I call up my PC.
So it went from training.
Yes.
To real life.
To real life.
Okay.
So yeah. I'm treating this patient. I've got a couple of other hands helping me. We're starting an IV on the patient. We're doing rapid cooling measures, cutting the guy's clothes off, putting ice in neck, axilla, inguinal, hands, feet,
right.
Trying to cool this guy down because he's in and out of consciousness. God. He's very obtundant. So I knew right away we had to remove him from the environment and get him someplace cooler and just start cooling this guy off.
Have you treated a heat cat like that before, or at least to that extent?
Not to that extent.
Okay.
He's probably one of the closest I've seen to an actual heat stroke before.
Right.
I don't think he was necessarily there yet, but
yeah.
He was well on his
okay.
way.
Yeah.
I had no running water, so my materials were very limited.
Mm-hmm.
So pouring water on this guy, putting ice in the places that I had it. I get on the radio, I call in my PC, and I explain what's going on. I said, we have a real nine-line mission. Are you comfortable with taking this patient to the hospital? Because at the end of the day, the PC was Kristen Beard, my favorite pilot.
From Camelsville.
From
you
Richmond.
Know this?
Oh.
She went to Taylor County, where I'm from.
Okay,
and
all right.
And we found out, me and my wife found out about Kristen, like, joining the military.
Yeah.
And everything that just kind of, you know, where she was at, we're sitting there, she was, oh, she's going to flight school and all this stuff. And then, yeah, it blew our mind.
Yes.
Very good for her, though. Very
yeah.
good. Shout out to her.
Absolutely.
Very good for her.
I couldn't have asked for a better PC that day.
Right.
She said, absolutely, we'll take the patient. So explain the situation. She lands. I gather up a litter team, secure my patient. We walk to the helicopter, secure them. And during this whole process where I'm treating this patient, a real-life patient, like we're not even in training mode. This is
right.
real life.
Yeah.
The Fort Hood instructor is evaluating me. He's not helping me. He's,
really?
Yes. He's sitting
checking
up in
the
seat.
Blocks?
Yeah, checking the blocks. Yeah, so all the way down. So we land. We call for an ambulance for transport to the hospital. And all the way down to the physician handoff, I was being evaluated.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah.
That is crazy. Okay.
But,
I don't know. Yeah, it blows my mind. Okay.
Yeah, but the patient ended up having a good outcome.
Yeah.
I saw him later on down in the MOB at a training event, so...
That's yeah, yeah, so was he great. One of the soldiers that were going was going as well?
Yeah, he was okay. one of the infantrymen.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That is wild. And right there, your training kicked in and saved.
Yeah, his... yeah. It's honestly, it's second nature.
Yeah.
And I feel more comfortable doing real life
right.
than yeah. faking it during a training event.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just what I'm more comfortable with.
Yeah. That is wild. Mm-hmm. Well, good for y'all. That is, and guy was saved and everything was good. And mm-hmm. did they not really have a medevac there for you? It was just, they just came straight to y'all and was like, hey, you're already doing this. Can you do this?
We were miles away from a hospital.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have the equipment that they needed to cool them off.
Yeah.
And we were 10 minutes away from the hospital. So they don't have air medical assets out
right.
there. But
wow.
our Kentucky helicopters were there that were fully outfitted with
yeah.
our portable ICUs. And they said, please take this patient. And of course we did.
That's awesome. That's mm-hmm. awesome story. And that's at pre-mob.
Pre-mob, yes.
That's how pre-mob goes.
Mm-hmm.
So pre-mob gets done. All right. So you've already kind of went through a scenario. Now we head over to Kosovo,
mm-hmm.
fly out. We get over there. What was kind of like one of y'all's first, what was the ways of the roads over there? What was y'all doing? You said you're down to single medic flying now, right? In
that's
the aircraft?
Correct.
Okay. Was y'all running like different type of medevac missions and stuff like that over there?
So the way it's set up, it kind of operates like a fire station, and you have
okay.
shifts,
mm-hmm.
and there's always medevac coverage 24/7. So there are four rooms within the med CP, which is where we live. We had operations. We have a PC, a PI, so two pilots, one crew chief, and one medic. Each person has their own room, and we were operating under 48-hour shifts.
Okay.
So
I got you.
For 48 hours, you're just basically waiting for a nine line to drop.
Yeah. And did y'all have quite a few?
We had, I believe, around 11.
Yeah.
Which really doesn't sound like a lot for a 10-month span. But the patients that we had, they're all extremely critical and needed multiple interventions. So whenever you got a call, you had to be on your A game.
You knew it. You knew
yes.
it.
Now, we ran single medic, but mm-hmm. if we knew that the patient was going to be super critical,
right.
there was always an extra flight paramedic available to hop on to assist if need be.
Yeah.
So nobody was ever alone if they didn't right. need to be alone.
Right. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I, man, that's that call, I guess that's the crazy thing to me. Like, you know, it's something probably serious at this point. And it did. It turned out to, well, all of them. But one thing that I know when we were going to talk about was this British service member, right? That was one of the big incidents that happened over there. Mm-hmm. Let's go into that, because I've kind of read the story a little bit, because it was kind of pushed back to the States and mm-hmm. very unique. But you had a team and y'all get a call, right?
That's correct. So the incident actually occurred on Camp Bonstil, which is where we were stationed.
Okay.
It was a British soldier who they were just doing some outdoor training in some tents. Soldier was stung by a bee, no history of allergies of any kind, and ended up going into anaphylaxis immediately. Luckily, they had the British surgeon there who was able to administer epinephrine, which is an emergency drug that helps open up the airway and kind of close your vessels.
Right.
So you can maintain your blood pressure and perfusion. He was able to administer that medication rapidly, but the patient went into what's called refractory anaphylaxis. So essentially the patient is no longer responding to your medications that you give them.
Okay.
And the mortality rate, which is death rate, is extremely high, and patients usually don't come out of this specific syndrome.
Really?
Yes.
So when he was administering this, was they hitting, where were y'all at? How far was this hangar, wherever y'all were at?
They were right down the road.
Okay.
So doc administers epi, patient goes into cardiac arrest, loses a heartbeat. So their medic and their surgeon throw the patient into an ambulance and drive them up to our battalion aid station,
okay,
which is a roll two.
Is this when y'all are aware of it now, or was y'all already aware when they were doing that other stuff as well?
We were not aware of it yet.
Okay.
We had, I think I wasn't there initially,
okay,
but I know that we had medics up at the aid station already.
Right.
So they were notified by the flight surgeon saying, hey, there is a very critical patient coming in, and the flight doc just went ahead and said, I want every single flight paramedic notified, and I want them up here to help me run this patient.
Right.
So we were notified of a critical patient, didn't know what we were walking into. Some of the medics got there before I did, but they were doing CPR, and they achieved what's called ROSC, which is return to spontaneous circulation. So the patient achieves their heart rhythm again, and you have to start administering medications. Like, you have to act quickly. And that's about the time that I walked in. The patient was already on a magnesium drip for airway support.
Right.
They are talking about doing an epinephrine drip, which is to help vascular support, basically.
So from CPR, right?
From
regular CPR.
CPR.
Bring him back.
Patient is talking again. Unheard of. I've worked in emergency medicine for 10 years, and the fact that a patient lost their heartbeat, they're able to get it back, refractory anaphylaxis, and for them to maintain a mentation where they can tell us their name and they can tell us how they're feeling.
Yeah.
It's truly unheard of, and I think the patient's age and his health and the quick interventions that occurred is truly what saved his life. But we work closely with the Louisiana aid station team. And then whenever we got all of our medics into that room, it was chaos.
Yeah.
Whenever I had initially walked in.
Yeah.
Things were just being thrown. People were yelling. Everyone's stressed out.
Right.
But the Kentucky Flight paramedics walk into that room, circle around the patient, and everybody gets out of the way and watches.
Yeah.
And we don't even have to talk to one another.
Right.
We're just doing things. So the pad is getting ready to drop a 9-line. We've already got the patient on a litter ready for transport. We're putting them on the cardiac monitors.
Everyone's getting
the IV pump set up for the epinephrine drip. I'm pushing push dose pressors because the patient was just actively trying to die.
Yeah.
So we had to give constant pressure support to keep him perfusing.
Right.
And he's
already responding back to y'all at this point?
Yes.
But you still have to do all this stuff?
Yeah, we're still having to do this stuff.
Because at any moment he can go right back?
Yes, because the patient's circling the drain right now, and we have to act quickly.
Okay.
Because his body's saying, I don't want to respond to these medications, but we're saying no. We're going to push more, and we're going to give more until you don't have a choice, which is what we did. And just seeing our team come together, form a plan. Flight paramedic Ryan Hunter was very quick to recognize that this was, in fact, refractory anaphylaxis. And I think that quick recognition happened to get us a very quick plan of action, and everyone just knew what to do after that. So,
and that's to me, like you saying, was it Staff Sergeant Hunter? Is that who you said?
Staff Sergeant Hunter, yeah.
Just like you have to know that, right? You have to know what course of action you're going to take.
Yes.
And then trust it.
Yes.
You're like, hey, this is what I think it is. Pretty certain, but this is what I think. And then we're all just going to attack it that way. And then y'all just all took off with it. And that's unbelievable.
Yep. So usually whenever you're working a code or a critical care patient, you have a leader.
Yeah.
Somebody who speaks up and somebody who controls the chaos.
Yeah.
And that day it was Staff Sergeant Ryan Hunter.
Yeah.
And he stepped and he said, this is what's going on with this patient. This is what I think we need to do. Here's how we're going to do it. Here's everybody's jobs. I need the room to be quiet. And if you aren't working on the patient, I need you to step away. And the doctor said, okay.
Listen to him.
And that's what we did.
Preach, brother, preach. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was an amazing thing to see. It really was.
I bet. Yeah, I bet.
And the most amazing thing about that story is through everything that patient had been through, cardiac arrest, he was discharged from the hospital the next day. And he came back.
Ready to get, like walking and everything. Walking. Talking. And
Yeah. He was sore, of course, from chest compressions. And, he came to visit the flight paramedics and he said, thank you guys. And out of all the bad days that you have on a MOB, getting a patient who essentially should have died, statistically should have died, to come up to you and say, thank you for saving my life, there's nothing like it. It made that entire MOB worth it.
Right. That's amazing. And all from a bee sting.
One bee sting.
Like you know, the heat cats or, you know, anything, broken bones and stuff like that. But this guy's out training, gets a bee sting, and it turned into that, like chaos that quick.
Yes.
And I think that's what amazes me about the human body and the medical side anyways, is that. But it sounds like, that was a hell of a team y'all had.
It was. And I have to give accolades to our pilots and our crew chief.
Right.
Because before the 9-line even dropped, it has to go through several channels.
Yeah.
Before the 9-line even dropped, the helicopter was outside waiting for the patient.
Ready to go.
So,
You
know, our times, our average patient time from 9-line to getting them into a helicopter for evacuation was under 5 minutes each and every time.
Just ready to go.
The standard is 15 minutes.
So super quick.
Very quick. It's very fast.
But all because of the training, right? I mean, y'all practice this, the scenarios y'all went through, and it just shows. I mean, it just did nothing but fine-tune you guys, and y'all were all working unit. So, and that is amazing, especially in that field. I mean, like I said, there's different fields we're all in, but I mean, this has come to life or death situations almost every time for you guys, or pretty bad circumstances at least, and y'all being able to figure that out together or making decisions yourself.
Yes,
you know, it's on you, and that's a big ordeal.
It's a big deal, and the people who are in the unit know that we are going to get called on somebody's worst day of their life.
Yes, that's what I should have said. That you're not getting good calls. It seems like if that phone's ringing or something comes across that radio, it's probably going to be an emergency, and that's the calls you're going to receive.
Yeah, it's a job that you can't take lightly because somebody hears that helicopter and they get a sense of ease, and they said they're here.
Yeah,
and you know, if you can't own up to that position and perform at the top level of the expectation of your patient or that patient's family members,
right. You
don't need to be there. And the entire team that we have is up for that mission.
Yeah, they've accepted. Mm-hmm. They're ready to go.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And we always talk about the kind of the camaraderie of that, you know, platoon or that unit or whatever. So, I mean, it already sounds like that's just a family over there.
It's a family.
And that's amazing. And you're all trained together. You don't want each other to fail. You want each other to succeed and stuff. So, very cool. Very cool. Mm-hmm. So, everything else on the MOB went fine and you –
Yeah.
Performed well, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, we didn't just do medical coverage. You know, we had an off tempo and we trained over 5,000 NATO allied soldiers, which is a huge deal for 10 months. We did so much training.
Yeah.
How to load patients safely onto an aircraft.
Right.
Discussing our capabilities. There were many a times where we had to have a translator because the other soldiers just didn't speak our language.
Right.
We trained with Brits. We trained with the Germans. It was just such a great networking opportunity for us. And just like we do here in Kentucky, we network. We did over there in Europe, which was super cool.
That's wild. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And y'all just got back here recently, right? You ain't been home too long.
Yeah, about 2 months.
Home. Yeah. Has everything been good with the unit since y'all been back? I guess a little downtime, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah. Everyone's getting a little R&R. We just did our post-mob yellow ribbon event at Keeneland. So getting to see everybody all dressed up with their families and happy.
It's amazing.
It was great.
That's amazing. Well, Sergeant Renee, thank you so much for coming in and telling the stories. I could sit here all day. Very amazing. Kudos to y'all's team and the things y'all did. And very awesome to hear some of the life-saving events that y'all have done. I mean, it's amazing. Your hands are doing it. So that's what's cool about it. But before you go, before we close out, I want to give you a quick gift. It's for the G3 podcast. We kind of settled on this. So something you can put on your desk or you can have your morning coffee out of or whatever, because we really do appreciate you coming and talking to us today.
Yeah.
Very cool. And you're right across the way. You might send me over there.
Yeah, for sure.
Bring me over for a hoist mission.
Patch is for you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll have
giving you a shout
represent.
Out. It's the first patch I've gotten. Thank you.
The coolest patch you'll ever get, too.
That is a cool patch, and I'm a hardcore UK fan, so this is going to be even more amazing.
Awesome.
Appreciate you. Appreciate everybody at the Medevac. With that, hope everybody's safe. I hope everybody's taken care of. Thank you for tuning in. And with that, enjoy life, be healthy, and stay lethal. G3 Podcast out.
Thank you for joining us on the Kentucky National Guard G3 Podcast, where we bring you the voices and stories behind the mission. Stay connected, stay ready, and we'll see you on the next episode.